This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the world of Forbes, Barron's, and Fortune magazines. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization. My name is Greg Conroy. So let's get down to business. Starting with Forbes magazine, Dead in the Water. Hundreds of private equity firms are now drowning in a sea of competition, searching for lifeboats of new capital as they cling to portfolios of nearly unsaleable investments. Meanwhile, their investors are losing patience. Little more than 1 year ago, New York City's Vestar Capital sent a surprising message to its limited partners. After decades of growth, it was scrapping plans for its eighth private equity fund and would instead focus on improving its existing portfolio of companies. Its most recent fund, Vestar Capital Partners 7, launched in 2018 with $1.1 billion, but has been limping along with an internal rate of return of 7.7%, significantly lagging the S&P's average return of 14% over the same period. Vestar was born in 1988 during private equity's first boom, the same year a brash NYC firm known as Kohlberg, Kravis, and Roberts took down mighty RJR Nabisco for $25 billion. Back when deals were called LBOs and dealmakers were known as corporate raiders. A lot has changed since then. With more than 15,000 firms worldwide and $9 trillion in global assets, private equity is now mainstream. Vestar's founders were bankers at First Boston, who left to specialize in buying and selling companies like Red Plastic, Cup King, Solo, and Big Heart Pet Brands, known for milk bones. One of their best deals, the $175 million purchase of Birds Eye Foods, sold in 2009 for $1.3 billion. But now Vestar is looking inward to 12 companies it picked up over the last 13 years, including veggie food brand Dr. Prager's, frozen berry processor Titan, and Pet Honesty, maker of alternative medicines for pets. Vestar hasn't invested in a single new portfolio company since 2023, and it announced the sale of only one in 2025, unloading cracker maker Simple Mills, in which it bought a stake in 2019, to Flowers Foods, Inc. for $795 million. In an industry built on the constant churn of buying and flipping companies for a profit, Vestar's future is in question. Its assets under management have withered from $7 billion 15 years ago to $3.3 billion as of its latest SEC filing in 2024. Vestar declined to comment for this story. Welcome to private equity's new era, the age of the PE zombie. Similar stories are playing out throughout North America and Europe as an industry that was once a golden ticket, minting dozens of billionaires, is going through difficult times. Consulting firm Bain & Company reported last year that more than 18,000 private capital funds were in the market, collectively seeking to raise $3.3 trillion, but it projected the total amount raised would be only a third of that, with more being allocated to credit and infrastructure funds rather than traditional buyout strategies. Data from private equity analytics firm Preqin shows that the average fund that closed in 2025 spent 23 months in the market fundraising, up from 16 months in 2021, and fewer funds are meeting their fundraising goals at all. In 2025, a total of 1,191 buyout funds raised $661 billion, down from 2,679 funds and $807 billion in 2021. Blue chip mega funds continue to attract capital, bucking the trend. Thomas Bravo raised $24.3 billion in its 16th flagship fund last year. Blackstone closed on a $21.7 billion fund, and Veritas Capital raised $14.4 billion. Veritas's billionaire CEO Ramzi Mousalam told Forbes that consolidation is favoring high performers, adding that, quote, a lot of funds that exist today won't necessarily exist 5 years from now, close quote. Firms that don't have top-tier performance or unique strategies are getting left behind. In an industry whose lifeblood is fresh capital, there are simply too many funds and not enough dollars in pensions, endowments, and other institutions to satisfy all of them. A large number of mid-level firms are becoming zombies, holding on to dwindling portfolios of companies they can't sell and struggling to raise money to buy new businesses. Quote, there is existential risk for a number of funds because of the fundraising environment, close quote, says Sunaina Sinhaldia, global head of private capital advisory at Raymond James. Quote, if existing investors don't come and support them, new investors are highly unlikely to, close quote. Forbes has compiled a list of 20 big private equity zombies, businesses that are either scaling back, like Vestar, or simply treading water. According to PitchBook, hundreds of established firms in North America and Europe haven't raised a new buyout fund since 2020. 20 of the firms are some of the largest. They either haven't been able to tap investors in at least 5 years or have been forced to raise a fraction of the amount of their prior funds. Private equity partnerships have long been structured to deploy the capital they raise in the first 3 to 5 years after closing a fund. Then, in the next 3 to 7 years, those investments are sold and profits realized. Add it together and investors expect their cash back, and then some, about 10 years after they invest. Management fees are typically around 2% during the initial investment period and lower afterward. Standard performance fees are 20% after clearing a hurdle, which is often set at around 8%. A top-performing fund that generates lofty performance fees or carried interest can make a private equity manager ultra-rich. No fewer than 33 members of last year's Forbes 400 made their fortunes in private equity. But managers usually don't struggle financially, even if they habitually underperform. Annual management fees keep the lights on in good times and bad. And even for shrinking companies like Vestar, they can amount to tens of millions per year. Such fees incentivize firms to raise a new fund every 5 years or so to lock in a fresh batch of dependable earnings, or to hang on to their highest prized assets if they can't flip them for a healthy profit. In the current environment, carried interest windfalls are increasingly rare, especially for firms that overpaid for companies during the run-up in asset values afforded by the easy credit conditions that persisted until 2021. Returns are down across the board. 3-year annualized returns through June 2025 for the Cambridge Associates U.S. Private Equity Index are a mere 7.4%, underperforming the MSCI World Stock Index by 11 percentage points annually. That's a steep drop from private equity's market-beating 14.7% 10-year annualized returns and 13.7% 20-year returns. In many cases, managers are forced to decide between sitting on an asset and continuing to collect management fees or selling without any prospect of a performance fee because they failed to meet their 8% hurdle rate. It's no wonder that the average holding period of buyout deals has increased to 6.3 years in 2025, up from around 5.1 years in 2020. Quote, something we're seeing develop now is general partners who are not able to raise the next fund, but also not willing to sell trophy assets because of the fee stream that's attributed to those, close quote, says Tom Donovan, global co-head of primary capital advisory at Los Angeles-based Houlihan Lokey. Quote, if they sell the asset, the fees fall away, close quote. Onex Partners, the largest outfit on our zombie list with $23 billion in assets, closed its fifth flagship buyout fund in 2017 with $7.2 billion, surpassing its $6.5 billion target. The Toronto-based buyout firm had raised progressively larger flagship funds every few years, $3.5 billion in 2006, $4.7 billion in 2009, $5.7 billion in 2015. A $375 million check to acquire Spirit AeroSystems, which manufactures airplane parts, from Boeing in 2005, turned into $3.2 billion in returns by the time it took the business public and sold off the last of its stake in 2014. Onex's net internal rate of return for its first buyout fund, including that home run, was 38% over a period when the S&P returned 9.5%. That kept investors hungry for more, even as its subsequent funds didn't replicate that performance with rates of return between 7% and 13%. But in 2023, Onex paused fundraising for its sixth flagship fund, a year after it said $1.5 billion of the $2 billion raised to date for the fund would be from its parent company, Onex Corporation. Chief Executive Robert LeBlanc called the fundraising environment then, quote, the most difficult the industry's ever seen, close quote, at the firm's 2023 Investor Day, saying Onex, quote, got caught in a bad part of the fundraising cycle, close quote. Last year, it did manage to raise $1.2 billion for a, quote, opportunities fund, close quote. But to do so, it had to promise its limited partners a shorter two-year investment period than its typical 5 to 7 years. In terms of fresh exits, Onex has been luckier than most zombies. In October, it was able to sell a specialty insurer called Convex, which it co-founded in 2019, for $7 billion. But there was no bidding war. Convex sold to the PE firm's parent company, which brought in AIG as a partner. Though no one is shedding a tear for private equity fund managers, the fundraising slump has taken a toll on their fees. Total management fee revenue from Onex's private equity segment has fallen from $146 million in 2019 to $93 million in 2024 and is currently running at an annual rate of $81 million, according to recent filings. It's in good company. Chicago's Madison Dearborn Partners, known for investments such as asset manager Nuveen, Yankee Candle, and LA Fitness, has raised a total of $36 billion in 8 funds since it was formed in 1992. Its 8th and latest buyout fund closed in 2021 and is logging a 12% internal rate of return compared to about 15% for the S&P's annual returns. It's reportedly seeking to raise $3 billion for its 9th fund, which would be its smallest raise since its 3rd fund, which closed in 1999. New York's Cirrus Capital closed a $3.5 billion technology buyout fund in 2019. It has an IRR of 8.3%. Over the same period, the NASDAQ Composite Index posted 16% annually. SEC filings show that it tried to raise $4 billion in 2022, but managed only $339 million. Crestview Partners closed a $2.4 billion fund in 2019, which has recorded an 8.4% IRR, while the IRR for its prior $3.1 billion fund was only 1.4%, less than most people earn on their money market accounts. Quote, if you had two good funds and then a bad fund, you have some hope. You've got to convince people that the next fund will be better, close quote, says Stephen Kaplan, a private equity expert at the University of Chicago. Quote, if you've had two bad funds, you're probably out of luck, close quote. Even more important than IRR, which is essentially an internal and somewhat fudgeable estimate, is something called DPI, or the, quote, distributed to paid in capital ratio. In simple terms, it means the amount of cash investors have gotten back divided by how much they paid into a fund. Washington State pension fund documents show that of the $233 million it paid into Vestar's 2018 fund, it has gotten $140 million back as of June 2025. That equates to a DPI ratio of 0.6x. A decade ago, 7-year-old funds typically reported DPIs of 0.8x. Madison Dearborn Capital Partners 8, a 2020 vintage fund, is so far reporting 0.3x DPI. Consulting firm Bain & Company's mid-year report last year said the median buyout DPI for 2020 vintage funds in the U.S. and Western Europe was less than 0.2x, while the median DPI for 2019 funds was 0.4x, trailing historical benchmarks for funds at similar stages by more than 10 percentage points. The illiquidity trend is getting worse. Distribution yields, measuring the percentage of net asset value that is returned to investors each year, have sunk to 11% on average in the last 3 years from over 25% a decade ago, according to Bain. Quote, no one's model expected 9-year holds or 10% distribution yields, close quote, says Scott Ramsauer, head of private equity funds at the Teacher Retirement System of Texas. Quote, all our models are telling us we should not put as much money into the market in 2026 as we thought we were going to a year ago, close quote. But never count crafty financiers out. Beleaguered buyout funds have options even when sources of new capital are scarce. So-called quote-unquote continuation funds are all the rage now in private equity. They essentially allow PE firms to buy time by cashing out impatient limited partners while still holding on to certain investments. After $7 billion in assets, Crestview Partners reportedly paused its latest flagship fundraise. It closed a $600 million continuation fund last year to maintain ownership of two companies it acquired out of an earlier 2015 fund. Despite its difficulties, a firm spokesman insists it, quote, has significant recyclable capital available for investments and exploring a host of compelling opportunities, close quote. Many of the zombies on our list, like Vestar, Palladium Equity, Brentwood Associates, Revelar Capital, and Norwegian firm FSN Capital, have raised continuation funds in the last 2 years. Onex is said to be gathering $1.6 billion to explore this route. Evercore's private capital advisory group reported that continuation funds, which carry lower management fees, raised $62 billion in 2024 and more than $40 billion in the first half of 2025, up from nearly nothing a decade ago. Quote, ultimately, a continuation vehicle is helpful in terms of the DPI story. It's helpful in terms of giving a promising asset more runway, but it's not giving you fresh powder to go out and invest in new deals, close quote, says Sarah Sandstrom, the head of North American private equity placement at London-based Campbell Lightens. Quote, most young folks are going to get a lot of satisfaction out of doing new deals, so having a reliable pool of dry powder is an important element of keeping the very best talent, close quote. Another option is to bring co-investment opportunities to limited partners, which decrease fees and fundraising needs for general partners by enabling institutions to invest directly in portfolio companies. Switzerland-based PE firm Capvis is going further, opting to raise money separately for each deal it pursues after a futile fundraising effort. What about wealth management and the prospect of trillions in retail money, potentially from retirement accounts, coming to the rescue? Not likely. Quote, the gatekeepers at the wirehouses, registered investment advisors, and banks are very quality-motivated and very size-motivated, close quote, says Raymond James Haldia. Quote, retail has been the foray of the Blackstones and the Arises and so forth, close quote. That's bad news for hundreds of mid-lane private equity firms waiting for a lifeboat that may never come. Continuing in Forbes, America's most generous people. No one has ever given away more money as fast as Mackenzie Scott. The ex-wife of Jeff Bezos was the nation's top philanthropist in 2025 and ranks third behind Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and Melinda French Gates in terms of lifetime giving. Amid a furious political backlash around diversity, equity, and inclusion, Mackenzie Scott has stepped up for her principles, donating at least $760 million to 18 historically black colleges and universities over 3 months late last year. As she has done since her 2019 divorce from Jeff Bezos, Scott gave the money without fanfare and with few strings attached. The biggest gift was $80 million to Howard University, $17 million of which was directed to the medical school. The rest Howard can spend as it wants. Quote, unrestricted funds of this size are beyond the ordinary, close quote, a Howard spokesperson tells Forbes, noting that the school found out about the grant only when someone from Scott's Yield Giving emailed the university. In all, 186 organizations received a collective $7.2 billion in 2025 from Scott, who has disposed of more than 75% of the Amazon shares she received from Bezos, enough to make her the world's most generous philanthropist last year. It's the most donated in a single year since Forbes started tracking top givers in 2012. In less than 7 years, Scott has donated $26.4 billion to more than 2,500 groups. Only Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and Melinda French Gates have donated more, each over a much longer time. Forbes still counts the Gates' giving together, but Melinda also has her own money, including at least $8.9 billion her ex-husband donated to her Redmond, Washington-based pivotal philanthropies after she left the Gates Foundation in 2024 to influence charitable giving. Quote, "The longer I do this, the more deeply I feel that philanthropists are most useful when we're standing behind movements led by others instead of trying to lead movements of our own," close quote, French Gates says. Case in point, she has donated $540 million to nonprofits focused on social progress for women and girls, calling issues affecting them, quote-unquote, unconscionably underfunded. That women are leading the charge to diversify and speed up giving should come as no surprise. According to Maddie Navalu, who runs wealth manager Iconic's philanthropic arm, women tend to give faster and more generously. That's partly because people who are not founders or primary creators of their wealth are more open to taking, quote-unquote, more risks, because in some ways they feel less ownership, according to Cecilia Conrad, CEO of Lever for Change, a nonprofit that pools funds from wealthy givers, including French Gates, Scott, and at least three other billionaires. Pooled funds, which cut down the time and money needed to find and vet charities, are gaining traction. Quote, "Increasingly, we're focused on collaboration with other donors," close quote, says Carrie Tuna, the wife of Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz and chair of Coefficient Giving, which directed $100 million to AI safety last year. Quote, "It's always been a part of my vision," close quote, adds French Gates. Quote, "Women know there's a lot of power in collective action, and giving circles are a chance for everyday givers to make their resources go further," close quote. The trend toward accelerated giving is also picking up speed. In late 2023, Warren Buffett, 95 years old, said his children would have just 10 years to give away his money, currently $146 billion, after he dies. Last May, Bill Gates announced that his foundation would adopt a 20-year spend-down approach. And in July, several top givers, including Gates, Charles Koch, and Steve Ballmer and his wife Connie, together pledged $1 billion over 15 years to increase economic mobility using AI. Aging Americans are expected to pass on more than $120 trillion, the largest intergenerational wealth transfer ever, and women will be the biggest beneficiaries. Says French Gates, quote, "From a philanthropic perspective, I can't wait to see what they will do with it," close quote. Here's a sidebar item. Top givers. So far, the nation's top 25 philanthropists have donated $275 billion, $34 billion more than a year ago. That's a huge sum, but represents just 14% of their combined fortunes, the smallest percentage since 2021. Not generous enough to make the cut, Elon Musk and Larry Page, the world's two richest people, who together are worth more than $1 trillion. So here's the list. Warren Buffett, lifetime giving, $68.3 billion. Giving focus, health, poverty, alleviation. Giving as percentage of net worth, 32%. Net worth, $146 billion. Now retired, the former Berkshire Hathaway CEO donates his money via the Gates Foundation and his family's foundations. Number two, Bill Gates and Melinda French Gates, $52.6 billion. Health, poverty alleviation, 28%, $134 billion. Mackenzie Scott, $26.4 billion. Education, economic equity, 46%, $30.9 billion. Michael Bloomberg, $25.4 billion. Climate change, health, education, 19%, $109 billion. The United Nations Climate Envoy pledged $100 million to cut methane emissions and another $100 million to help eradicate polio last year. George Soros, $24 billion. Democracy, human rights, 76%, $7.5 billion. Chaired by his son, Alex, Soros' Open Society Foundation gave more than $1 billion in 2024 to groups promoting justice and human rights. Number six, Marilyn Simons and family, $10.3 billion. Science, math, 24%, $32.6 billion. In April, the widow of quant trader Jim Simons, who died in 2024, pledged $80 million to launch the Simons Collaboration on Ecological Neuroscience. Number seven, Steve and Connie Ballmer, $6.5 billion. Economic mobility, 4%, $141 billion. In November, the Bombers committed $1 billion to a Washington pre-K program and $72 million to behavioral health clinics in Illinois, Kansas, and Michigan. Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chen, $6.1 billion. All Powered Biology, 3%, $213 billion. The couple's Chan Zuckerberg initiative is doubling down on its biohub and AI-powered biology. Sergey Brin, $5.1 billion. Parkinson's, climate change, 2%, $249 billion. The Google co-founder has donated $2.2 billion to support Parkinson's disease research, including $477 million in 2025. Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez Bezos, $4.7 billion. Climate, homelessness, 2%, $250 billion. Their Bezos Earth Fund has donated $2.4 billion of $10 billion promised by 2030 to combat climate change, funding innovations like AI-powered coral reef monitoring. Number 11, Phil and Penny Knight, $4.5 billion. Education, medical research, 12%. $31.8 billion. The Nike co-founder and his wife pledged $2 billion to the Oregon Health and Science University's Knight Cancer Institute in August. Dustin Moskovitz and Kerry Tuna, $4.3 billion. Global Health, AI Safety, 29%, $10.5 billion. Number 13, Barbara Peacower, $4.1 billion. Democracy, Medical Research. She's worth more than $1 billion. The widow of Jeffrey Peacower, who died in 2009, top beneficiary of Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme, donated over $400 million to her democracy-focused Freedom Together Foundation last year. Number 14, Lynn and Stacy Schusterman, $4 billion. Education, Jewish community, 47%, $4.4 billion. Longtime donors to Jewish causes, the wife and daughter, respectively, of oil billionaire Charles Schusterman, who died in 2000, also backed broader societal change, including helping the formerly incarcerated. Number 15, Edith Broad and family, $3.6 billion. Education, arts, 34%, $7 billion. In April, the Broad Museum in Los Angeles, funded by insurance tycoon Eli Broad, who died in 2021, and his widow, Edith, broke ground on a $100 million expansion. Number 16, Michael and Susan Dell, $3.3 billion. Education, economic stability, 2%, $139 billion. The Dells committed $6.25 billion to seed 25 million investment accounts, dubbed Trump accounts, for children under 10 as part of the President's Invest America initiative, which kicks off July 4th. Number 17, Pierre and Pam Omidyar, $3.1 billion. Poverty, alleviation, human rights, education, 20%, $12.1 billion. Their Omidyar network gives to Humanity AI, which helps citizens shape AI technology. Number 18, Eric and Wendy Schmidt, $2.9 billion. Education, scientific research, 7%, $37.2 billion. The Schmidts are part of a group pledging $1 billion to the world's largest particle physics lab, CERN, to fund a successor to the Large Hadron Collider. Number 19, Billy Marcus and family, $2.7 billion. Medical research, Jewish causes. They're worth over $1 billion. Home Depot co-founder Bernie Marcus, who died in 2024, and his wife's foundation gave $30 million to Stanford Neurosurgery in April. Number 20, Ken Griffin, $2.5 billion. Medical research, education, 5%, $51.8 billion. In September, Griffin committed $50 million to help launch Success Academy charter schools in Miami, where he moved in 2022. George Kaiser, $2.5 billion. Education, health, 14%, $15.7 billion. The Tulsa, Oklahoma Billionaires Foundation donated $253 million in 2025, primarily to provide children and families opportunities for economic mobility in his hometown. Number 22, John and Laura Arnold, $2.3 billion. Education, criminal justice reform, 44%, $2.9 billion. The couple awarded 900 plus grants in 2025 to programs in areas like career development, housing, and education. Number 23, Reed Hastings and Patty Quillen, $2.2 billion. Education, 31%, $4.9 billion. The Netflix co-founder and his wife gave $50 million to his alma mater, Bowdoin College, in March to launch the Hastings Initiative for AI and Humanity. Number 24, Donald Brenn, $2.1 billion. Education, conservation, 10%, $19.2 billion. The real estate baron has endowed more than 60 professorships. Number 25, Charles Koch, $2 billion. Education, poverty alleviation, 3%, $73.8 billion. His foundation doled out $68 million in 2024, including $30 million to George Mason University and its Institute for Humane Studies. Moving now to barons. Airline CEOs urge Congress to end government shutdown, pay airport workers. This is by Janet Cho. 10 CEOs from the nation's largest passenger and cargo airlines urged Congress to end the partial government shutdown that has led to long airport security lines and disrupt the agency charged with airport security for the second time in less than 2 months. They want Congress to fix things so these workers, operating critical airport security functions, get paid regardless of the status of federal government funding. Quote, once again, air travel is the political football amid another government shutdown, unquote, the executive said in a letter that was released on Sunday. The plea comes amid reports of long lines at airport security checks, with Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy telling Fox's Sunday Morning Features that so far 300 TSA agents have quit and the number of callouts are double what they were before the shutdown began last month. Funding for the Department of Homeland Security, which is responsible for the Transportation Security Administration, where tens of thousands of officers are working without pay, has been held up amid a congressional battle over returns for another DHS agency, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Lawmakers have tried repeatedly to pass DHS funding with no success. Another vote failed in the Senate last Thursday. Americans, quote, in your districts and home states are tired of long lines at airports, travel delays, and flight cancellations caused by shutdown after shutdown, close quote, the CEOs wrote in the letter. The letter was signed by Alaska Air Group CEO Ben Minicucci, American Airlines Group CEO Robert Isom, Atlas Air Worldwide CEO Michael Steen, Delta Airlines CEO Ed Bastian, FedEx Airlines CEO Richard W. Smith, JetBlue Airways CEO Joanna Garrity, Southwest Airlines CEO Bob Jordan, United Airlines CEO Scott Kirby, UPS Executive Vice President Nando Cesaroni, and Airlines for America President and CEO Christopher Sununu. The executives urged congressional leaders to, quote, immediately come together to reach an agreement, close quote, to fund DHS and then act to ensure that, quote, this problem never happens again, close quote. They are calling on Congress to pass laws that would guarantee paychecks for air traffic controllers and TSA officers regardless of the government funding status. Lawmakers want reforms to how ICE operates after the shooting deaths of two American citizens by ICE and Customs and Border Protection agents in Minneapolis earlier this year. Congressional efforts to pay TSA officers, Federal Emergency Management Agency workers, and other non-immigration employees separately from the rest of DHS agencies have also failed. Weather has added to travelers' frustrations. Nearly 2,300 flights to and from U.S. airports were canceled, and more than 7,000 flights were delayed as of 6 p.m. Eastern Time Sunday as a winter storm barreled across the Midwest. That included more than 800 flights at Chicago O'Hare and more than 660 at Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, according to FlightAware.com's live flight tracking site. SkyWest Airlines had canceled more than 500 flights, and Delta Airlines had canceled more than 400 flights, while Southwest and American Airlines each delayed more than 1,100 flights. Chicago O'Hare is reporting average delays of 216 minutes because of thunderstorms, the Federal Aviation Administration said. Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International and Southwest Florida International Airport in Fort Myers are reporting delays averaging more than 90 minutes minutes because of thunderstorms, and Miami International and Orlando airports were both reporting ground stops. Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport is de-icing planes. The aviation executives note that with a record 17.1 million passengers expected to travel this spring break, quote, too many travelers are having to wait in extraordinary long and painfully slow lines at airport security checkpoints, close quote, including wait times of up to 5 hours or more, causing passengers to miss flights and forcing airlines to delay planes. Some airports, including Denver International, Seattle-Tacoma International, Harry Reid International in Las Vegas, and Cleveland Hopkins International, have been collecting gas and grocery gift cards, diapers, non-perishable food, and personal items for TSA officers and airport employees working without pay. The executives noted that 93% of Americans in a recent poll said they support paying federal aviation workers. Quote, with spring break travel in full swing, FIFA World Cup 2026 right around the corner, and celebrations for Americans' 250th birthday throughout the year, the stakes are especially high, close quote, the executives wrote. Continuing in Barron's, Berkshire could repurchase over $50 billion of stock annually based on recent buy. This is by Andrew Berry. Berkshire Hathaway probably is capable of repurchasing over $50 billion of stock annually if it chooses to be aggressive with stock buybacks. That would amount to about 5% of the company's shares outstanding based on Berkshire's market capitalization of nearly $1.1 trillion. An annual buyback of $50 billion plus is certainly doable given the company's earnings power of about $45 billion annually and its huge cash reserves of $373 billion. Many Berkshire holders would like to see the company get more aggressive with stock repurchases because they view the shares as undervalued and would like the company to draw down its cash reserves. Barron's $50 billion plus estimate is based on Berkshire's share repurchases of about $225 million on March 4th, the day it resumed buybacks for the first time since May 2024. The buybacks on March 4th could be determined from the share count as of the close of business on March 4th, listed in the Berkshire 2026 proxy statement released late Friday. There are about 250 trading days a year, and that suggests Berkshire could repurchase $56 billion of stock if it continued repurchases at a pace of $225 million a day. Continued buybacks hinge on Berkshire's stock price since the company is price sensitive, with CEO Greg Abel recently emphasizing in a CNBC interview that the company repurchases stock when the shares trade below intrinsic value, quote, conservatively determined, close quote. If the stock price rises, Berkshire may limit its buybacks. Berkshire doesn't disclose its estimates of intrinsic value, but many investors use book value as an understated proxy. The stock now trades for about 1.5 times the company's year-end 2025 book value, in the middle of its range over the past few years. The A shares ended Friday at $734,839 and the B stock at $490. Both are down around 2.6% this year, slightly ahead of the S&P 500, which is off about 2.8% after hitting a new low for the year on Friday. It's notable that the Berkshire buybacks on March 4th were about 10% of the company's trading volume that day of around $2.2 billion, which occurred overwhelmingly in the Class B shares. Barron's is assuming that Berkshire doesn't want to repurchase more than 10% of daily dollar volume, although it can buy nearly 25% of dollar volume based on Securities and Exchange Commission guidelines under the Rule 10b-18. Buying more than 10%, however, could move the stock and undercut Berkshire's goal of repurchasing stock as inexpensively as possible. During 2020 and 2021, when Berkshire repurchased $24.7 billion and $27.1 billion of stock, respectively, as the peak of its buybacks over the past decade, it bought back an average of about $100 million a day, or about 8% of average daily dollar volume, Barron's calculates based on Bloomberg data. The stock was cheaper than it is now in 2020 and 2021, trading at closer to 1.2 to 1.3 times book value. That was a driver of the big buybacks. Chairman Warren Buffett, 95, has talked about the possibility of repurchasing a lot of Berkshire stock, but that the company is constrained by the volume in the shares. Berkshire also could supplement open market buybacks with direct purchases from individual investors or institutions, although the company hasn't done a lot of that. Berkshire did buy back around $1 billion of stock in 2024 from Ruth Gotsman, the widow of longtime Berkshire director and Buffett friend David Sandy Gotsman, when she made a major donation. He died in 2022. Many Berkshire investors have talked about the possibility that the company could repurchase a chunk of what is likely to be heavy annual sales of stock by Buffett's foundation after his death. Those sales could total $15 billion annually as the foundation fulfills Buffett's desire to liquidate his estate and give away the money in about 10 years. Buffett's three children have been charged with giving away his fortune. An issue there is that Berkshire's board could see it as a conflict to buy stock directly from the foundation by giving it what could be viewed as potentially a favorable price. Berkshire doesn't appear to buy any stock that is sold annually by the Gates Foundation, the main current recipient of Buffett's annual charitable donations. There have been no disclosures of any Berkshire purchases of Gates Foundation stock that Barron's is aware of. The Gates Foundation sells the roughly $5 billion of stock it gets from Buffett annually, apparently in the open market. Next up in Barron's, what Iran means for oil and defense stocks. These could be the next opportunities. This is written by Al Root. The stock market is rarely about today. It's about tomorrow. The latest example of that truism is recent trading in shares of energy, defense, and chemical companies. Since fighting broke out in Iran on February 28th, the iShares Aerospace and Defense ETF is down 6%, despite the U.S. military spending almost $1 billion a day, pounding Iran with advanced missiles that will need to be replaced. That seems to be a boon to defense contractors, but the Iran war is a culmination of rising geopolitical tensions and in the long run probably won't do much to change the overall trend in defense spending. To be sure, the trend has been positive, with spending rising in the U.S. and Europe. That, more than anything, has benefited defense stocks. Before the conflict started, the iShares ETF was up 60% over the past 12 months. Shares of Northrop Grumman, for example, were up 57%, leaving the stock trading for about 25 times earnings estimated for the coming 12 months, up from 17 times a year ago. Higher P/E ratios are a sign that investors believe in accelerating earnings growth. There is, however, a small chance that the Iran conflict ends up hurting defense contractors. Quote, all else being equal, an outcome in the current war that severely degrades or eliminates an Iranian military threat could result in downward revisions to force and weapons requirements, close quote, wrote Capital Alpha Partners analyst Byron Callen in a recent note. A de-escalation of tension down the road is something defense investors will have to consider. The fighting isn't over, and Iran has managed to stop shipping through the Hormuz Strait, sending benchmark oil prices up more than 40% to over $1,000 a barrel. The iShares U.S. Energy ETF, however, is up only about 3% since the fighting started. ExxonMobil stock is up about 2%. Investors just aren't convinced yet that current energy prices will remain in place for the long term. Oil futures for 2028 have risen about $6 a barrel, or 10% since the end of February. Of course, the conflict will have long-term impacts. Shares of commodity chemical makers LyondellBasell and Dow Inc. are up 26% and 19%, respectively, since the conflict began. The pair has been upgraded 12 times by Wall Street analysts over that span. The war has taken low-cost commodity chemical capacity offline now and threatens the region's ability to bring more low-cost capacity online in the future. Fermium research analyst Frank Mitsch met with Liandell on February 25th and described the meeting as quote-unquote dour. He met with them again on March 3rd and, quote, the atmosphere was 180 degrees turn. The change in tenor from last week to this was palpable, close quote. The strength of the reaction also reflects how beaten up Dow and Leyendell stocks were. Both companies cut their dividends recently amid a brutal industry downturn that slashed profitability by more than 90% between 2022 and 2025. Dow and Leyendell shares both traded at roughly 5 or 6 times earnings estimates in 2022. Investors knew those good times wouldn't last forever in a cyclical commodity industry. Looking ahead, Adrian Helfert, CIO of Multi-Asset Strategies at Westwood, believes oil services will be an area to watch following the conflict. Infrastructure will need to be rebuilt in the Middle East and in Venezuela, he says. That thinking hasn't yet shown up in the stocks. The iShares U.S. Oil Equipment and Services ETF is down 8% since the start of fighting. Halliburton shares are down 6%. Maybe that's an area investors can focus on in the coming months as they watch the current conflict unfold. Of course, investors should pay attention to current events, but the key question will always be, how does it impact the future? Moving now to Fortune magazine, it's time to take Tether seriously. The leader in crypto stablecoins has $15 billion in the bank, U.S. expansion plans, and a CEO with a dark vision of the future. By Jeff John Roberts. Paolo Ardoino brightens at the thought of his family farm in the Italian province of Savona, not far from Genoa. Handsome and fit, he keeps weights and a gym bag in his office. Ardoino speaks at a merry musical clip as he recalls childhood summers working on hillsides alongside his grandparents. Quote, we grew the best tomatoes and asparagus in my region, close quote, he recalls. Quote, there are violet asparagus that are very rare and insanely good, and we were growing them, close quote. Ardoino smiles as he adds images of sage, rosemary, and olives to the recollection. His warm pastoral effect is unexpected, given his day job. Ardoino is the CEO of Tether, a secretive crypto firm that has become a symbol of both the growing power and the enduring perils of that industry. Tether reported more than $15 billion in profit for 2025. It has amassed more treasury bills than huge economies like South Korea and Germany, along with large stashes of Bitcoin and gold. This growing pile of assets has helped Tether use its flagship currency, a dollar-backed stablecoin called USDT, to rewire global financial networks. On January 1st, Ardoino announced that Tether had bought 8,888 bitcoins worth around $790 million. Today's stablecoins are ubiquitous. The blockchain-based dollars offer companies and consumers an efficient way to whisk money around, and companies from JP Morgan Chase to PayPal have rushed to issue them. Tether, however, dominates the sector thanks in part to a first-mover advantage that has resulted in USDT becoming the go-to way for millions of people in developing countries to hold dollars. USDT's market capitalization, $187 billion as of early January, and daily trading volume exceed those of all its stablecoin competitors combined, according to data from CoinMarketCap, even though U.S. citizens, with limited exceptions, are not allowed to use Tether's coin. Now, Tether is seeking to disrupt much more than finance. In the past 2 years, it has made massive investments in satellites, data centers, farming, telecommunication, and media. Those investments, which include $775 million in the social media platform Rumble, are a bet by Ardoino that he can replicate Tether's experimental growth in other sectors. And while Tether has long kept its operations offshore and its financials partly concealed from public view, the company last year seized on shifting political and regulatory winds to prepare an entry to the U.S. market and challenge the Coinbase-backed USDC stablecoin. Tether's ambitions are only likely to grow, raising the question of what Ardoino is seeking to achieve. Like other successful CEOs, he has a sweeping view of his company's mission, but his corporate vision is an unusually dark one. Having watched Europe descend into growing political and economic dysfunction, he believes the world is on a downward spiral and that Tether will serve as a financial and technological lifeline for communities as governments falter all around them. Quote, Of course, I wish the world would go toward a better place, close quote, says Arduino. Quote, but the reality is that entire economies, emerging markets, developing countries, are failing, close quote. It's a vision that's unsettling and for many far-fetched. Skeptics, though, should resist underestimating Arduino or dismissing him as a crypto huckster. Tether has already shown remarkable staying power, and in coming years, its wealth and influence are poised to grow even bigger. The capsule-shaped orange balloon flying over Lugano stands in contrast to the town's picturesque old-world plaza and its gorgeous deep blue lake ringed with mountains. The balloon is there to mark the kickoff of Plan B, a Bitcoin conference backed by Tether executives as part of a broader effort to brand Lugano, once a center of traditional finance, as pro-crypto. Tether, which has an office in the Central Plaza, has been instrumental in Lugano's crypto rebrand, investing heavily in local startups. Arduino says Lugano's three universities are one reason Tether chose it as a crypto hub. It also helps that the town is located in Switzerland, a country famous for efficiency and for asking few questions about where people get their wealth. Quote, there's beautiful weather, Italian food, Italian design and Italian culture, but you have Swiss organization, close quote, observes Arduino. Quote, Italy is a beautiful, lovely country, but it's hell if you try to do business, close quote. In the case of Tether, that business is a branch of crypto known as stablecoins, which remain fixed to the value of a fiat currency, typically the U.S. dollar. Tether's USDT is the original and most popular stablecoin. It first gained popularity among traders who value it for two attributes. It is not volatile like Bitcoin and other digital currencies, and it offers a way to keep proceeds within the crypto ecosystem, an arrangement that reduces transaction fees and avoids scrutiny from regulators. In recent years, though, the popularity of Tether has spread far beyond crypto insiders. In Argentina and Nigeria, whose economies are prone to bouts of rapid inflation, millions of people have taken to buying USDT as a way to hoard dollars. Tether's tokens are also becoming popular as a convenient currency for startups operating in developing economies. Quote, we have a lot of portfolio companies that use them a lot, close quote, says Matt Walsh, a founding partner of venture capital from Castle Island. Quote, in Africa, people ask for Tether by name. It's become a verb, close quote. As the supply of USDT has expanded, so too have Tether's profits. Its business model is simple. To maintain the USDT dollar peg, Tether holds a reserve of interest-bearing assets, mainly treasury bills, whose underlying value should maintain a one-to-one match with the amount of stablecoin in circulation. But crucially, the company doesn't pass on the interest it collects from the reserves to USDT holders. Instead, it keeps the proceeds from these reserve funds, which totaled around $5 billion 5 years ago, but have swelled to around $187 billion today. The resulting fat income stream, combined with Tether's lightweight operations, the company has fewer than 200 employees, has made it one of the most profitable businesses on the planet. For Arduino, the most logical outcome for the world right now is a fast-approaching economic collapse. It is this view that has led Arduino to tout the Tether brand as a byword for financial stability. In 2020, he and Debassini issued a new type of cryptocurrency, Tether Gold, which the company says can be redeemed for the equivalent value of the precious metal and whose market cap is now $2.3 billion. Today, Arduino is the face of Tether and exerts total control over all aspects of the company, according to an industry source. A rare sit-down interview with Arduino reinforced this account, as the CEO described overseeing all product decisions and reviewing every external communication. Arduino is not the founder, however. Tether's origins predate him by several years. The company's flagship stablecoin launched in 2014 under the name RealCoin, and the project was run by three co-founders, including Brock Pierce, a former child actor and longtime crypto dilettante. Soon after, though, the project acquired its current name and a path to success via an unlikely source, a one-time plastic surgeon named Giancarlo Debassini. Averse to media, Debassini does not grant interviews, and only wisps of him can be found online. The closest thing to a profile comes in the book Number Go Up by reporter Zeke Foe, which offers only a few faint clues to the 61-year-old's character, a racy cartoon, a tweet in support of Italy's anti-immigrant five-star movement political party, and a few blog posts. Devasini is present at the Plan B event, but in a near-spectral capacity. When spotted, Devasini is usually in the company of Valentina Picozzi, a 30-something artist who has made her own name in the Bitcoin world, with a series of statues, pseudonymous Bitcoin founder Satoshi Nakamoto, that have turned up at the New York Stock Exchange, and most recently on the Lugano lakefront during Plan B. The Lugano statue itself was a replacement for an earlier version that had been chucked in the lake by vandals. Arduino is among Devasini's admirers. Quote, he is one of the brightest people you can meet, close quote, he says. Quote, he has an intelligence that lets him view the world from many different angles and predict the most likely outcome, close quote. The pair met in London, where Devasini approached Arduino, who was running a fintech startup, to help deal with a flood of new customers at his Bitfinex cryptocurrency exchange. Despite a 20-year difference, the two Italians bonded over a shared love of math and common worldview. The relationship took on a mentor-protege dimension and over time resulted in Arduino running Tether. Quote, people think it is strange that a surgeon and a mathematician work in finance, but we look at the world like scientists, examining factors and evidence, trying to understand the most logical outcome, close quote, says Arduino. Quote, the point is that people will always look for leaders, but new leaders with different ideas cannot emerge in the current centralized environment, close quote, he says. Quote, they get censored and destroyed before they can gather a community. I am not here to judge ideas, but I want to defend people's right to have different ideas, close quote. Arduino also has his own view of what makes a good leader, pointing to El Salvador's Nayib Bukele. The Bitcoin-loving president, he says, has forged a successful new path by transforming the country from one of the most dangerous places on the planet to a safe and, Arduino says, an increasingly prosperous nation. I gently point out that Bukele's authoritarian tendencies and reported tolerance of human rights abuses mean some regard him more as a dictator than a leader. Arduino pushes back, noting that the president won a landslide victory in a 2024 election widely regarded as fair. I ask Arduino if he believes in democracy. He responds that it is hard to make it work, and that free speech and financial autonomy are essential elements of democracy, even if Europe has forsaken them. He believes Tether, however, has stayed true to those values. Quote, that is the thing that I think about the most, how Tether can be really covering different bases and be rooted in the fabric of the world, close quote, he says. Quote, I think we are the good guys, close quote. You've been listening to Down to Business. My name's Greg Conroy. This has been brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization, helping the low vision and blind communities in the St. Louis region since 1973. Have a great week. Take care.